One of the most difficult biblical parables to decipher is the parable of the unjust steward, which is also known as the parable of the shrewd manager. And the very different meanings we might draw from these alternate titles alone is part of the confusion. Here's a description of the parable by the Nothingness Principle.
In the parable, a rich man confronts his steward who has made poor use of the rich man's goods. Rather than trying to make it right, the steward decides to suck up to his master's debtors, cutting them sweetheart deals in hopes that they will take care of him after he's fired. So what does the rich man do? Well, he actually praises the steward for his prudent financial moves. He seems to miss the part about being cheated.
Some read the parable in straightforward fashion, as a celebration of shrewd pragmatism in the face of impending calamity, something we've all unfortunately been dealing with these past few months. Others, though, read it as a condemnation of this steward for his unjust actions in using his master's resources for his own benefit. But my interpretation is that while shrewd, the steward is necessarily unjust because he's trying to serve two masters, his boss and his boss's creditors, creating an inevitable conflict of interest. And as the parable closes, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. In the prosecution of Fred Freeman, several individuals presented themselves as shrewd managers, and it wasn't until years later that they were revealed to be unjust stewards.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The State vs. Fred Freeman. This is the third episode in a four-episode series about Fred Freeman, who was convicted of the 1986 murder of community college student Scott Macklem. I'm Rabia Chaudhry, I'm an attorney and author of A Dawn Story, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson, I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
As we noted at the end of episode 2, at the close of the defense case in the Fred Freeman trial, the prosecution was in a pickle. Whether it be hypnosis, shifting stories, or identifying someone other than Freeman in the police lineup, their eyewitnesses had issues. Meanwhile, Freeman had numerous alibi witnesses placing him in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which made it impossible for him to have driven to or from the scene of the murder of Scott Macklem in the Lower Peninsula in enough time. And so prosecutor Bob Cleland called pilot Bob Evans as a rebuttal witness at the very end of trial to testify that Freeman could have chartered a private plane to take him to and from the Lower Peninsula in enough time to commit the crime. Here, in an interview before he passed away, Freeman's defense counsel David Dean explains the importance of Evans being called as a rebuttal witness.
At trial, you have to understand, neither Fred nor I knew that the prosecutor, until rebuttal, the very last chance, we don't have a chance after him speaking, he brings up this theory that Fred had someone fly him down here. And, of course, there was no evidence during the trial or anything in the police reports to indicate that, in fact, that ever occurred.
Breaking that down, if Cleland planned to call Evans as an expert witness as part of his case in chief, he would have needed to disclose his existence and the nature of his planned testimony before the trial. In turn, the defense counsel could have prepared for Evans' testimony at trial and presented his own evidence and witnesses to challenge this theory as part of the defense case. But instead, Cleland was able to convince the judge that Evans only became relevant based on what unfolded at trial, meaning that pre-trial disclosure was unnecessary, and that Evans would get the last word. And what Evans said was almost too good to be true.
There was no evidence that Freeman had pre-arranged to fly from Escanaba to Port Huron on the day of the murder, let alone that he flew down there at all. But, according to Evans, no problem. He would testify that there was always a group of pilots hanging there at the airport, ready to fly a drive-up customer whenever they wanted. No questions asked. Here are a few excerpts from his testimony.
You sit and look at this thing all week and polish it, and you wait for somebody to come along. Put gas in it so you can fly it, you know? It's quite frequent for somebody to go out, come out Sunday or the spur of the moment, find a pilot hanging around. Hey, take me up. Somebody's always willing to do it. And ask somebody if they'd run them up there, and I'll pay the expenses. And most pilots, especially a private pilot, it's expensive flying, and they like to fly, and they'll go for any reason.
As Freeman's current attorney, Imran Syed, notes, this is ridiculous.
But then they come up with this theory of, well, theoretically, you can just go down to the airport, any small airport in Michigan in 1987, and you'll meet some random pilots just sitting there who'll fly you, you know, 400 miles and back and not make an official log of that flight. I mean, that's insane. There's no evidence that anything like that happened, yet that was presented to the jury in rebuttal in response to Mr. Freeman's alibi.
But for the state, the ridiculous became the sublime, as Richard Pellegrin, one of the jurors who convicted Freeman, remembered Evans's exact claims years later.
There are pilots in a restaurant. There's a restaurant there. They're waiting for things like this. Somebody comes in, and they say, well, we'd like to fly it. And boy, they jump on it, see?
So who was Bob Evans? As far as the jurors knew, he was a neutral and objective state's witness whose name likely evoked one of the most wholesome figures in American history.
There's lots of restaurants. We'd like you to pick ours. So Bob Evans, we do it right or we don't do it.
It wasn't until decades later that Freeman's pro bono private investigator would learn that Cleland and Evans didn't do it right. They didn't do it right at all.
What's some of the major work that you've done in that area looking into this theory about chartering the private plane?
So in 2008, I contacted Detective Harry Hudson, who was one of the two detectives that worked on this case. Detective Harry Hudson, I worked with for many years, and I can say that Harry Hudson is a good man. He was a good investigator, that he would never want to see an innocent person sent to prison for something they didn't do. But Harry Hudson wasn't the detective that was in charge of this case. He was one of two, but he had a sergeant that was over him as far as the leadership in the investigation of this case. But I met with Harry one evening in 2008 for about 2 hours and talked to him about this case. And when I talked to him about the airplane theory, he said to me, "Herb, you know who that the airplane pilot was, don't you?" And I said, "No, I have no idea. All I knew is his name was Robert Evans and that he had testified." Harry said that Bob Cleland, who was running for attorney general here in the state of Michigan that year, and in fact had just lost the election the day before the murder, when Bob Cleland would fly to his speaking engagements throughout Michigan, that Bob Evans was Bob Cleland's personal airplane pilot and would take him to these speaking engagements. And I had never known that. And of course, this wasn't brought out at trial.
An article from the local paper on the very day of the Macklin murder details the extent of this relationship. According to Cleland, he logged more than 6,000 miles in the air, traveling around Michigan to campaign for attorney general. So what ethical rules were violated by Cleland not disclosing his business relationship with Evans? Colin spoke with law professor Kevin McNunigal, an expert on prosecutorial ethics from Case Western University Law School.
Yeah, so can you tell me the issue with an attorney such as a prosecutor calling an expert or a quasi-expert witness and not revealing a relationship such as a business relationship with that witness?
Well, the primary issue is there's a constitutional duty to disclose exculpatory material that includes impeachment material, and this stuff would be clearly impeachment material. The witness could be attacked because of his prior relationship and all. So that should have been revealed. And there's also an ethical obligation, and the ethics rules of the state that requires prosecutors also to turn stuff over. So both, it's an ethical violation and a constitutional violation not to turn that stuff over.
And then there's the impact that the nondisclosure could have had on the jury.
The jury, without getting disclosure about this business relationship, is essentially thinking, oh, this is just a neutral objective witness, right?
Right. The risk is that they will overvalue the expert testimony if the guy's presented as, you know, somebody with some kind of expertise, and there's a lot of sort of, looks like sort of technical mumbo jumbo about times and play. Was this guy wealthy enough to have had access to a private plane to fly him back and forth and stuff, or was he?
No, he was on welfare. He was appointed counsel as indigent. So there's no indication he would have had the resources to be able to do this.
Yeah, so that makes it seem incredibly implausible.
And speaking of implausible, remember Cleland's claim that he shrewdly came up with a plan theory on the fly based on what happened at trial, meaning there didn't have to be pretrial disclosure? Well, one of Welser's reports notes the following. Harry Hudson stated this theory came from Bob Cleland. Harry told me that Bob Cleland would have frequent meetings with himself and Sergeant Bounds regarding the case and was, quote, very demanding. He stated that it was during one of these meetings that Bob Cleland came up with a theory that possibly Frederick Freeman took an airplane back to Escanaba after committing the murder. So yeah, the jury never learned about the serious conflict of interest that Evans had based on his business relationship with Cleland, and Cleland's sandbagging by labeling Evans a surprise rebuttal witness put the defense behind the eight ball. But while Bob Evans presented a theory about how Freeman could have committed the murder, and while the state's eyewitnesses testified that Freeman could have been in the community college parking lot before and after the murder, the state still needed some evidence that Freeman actually, you know, committed the murder.
Oftentimes you get these cases where the prosecution doesn't seem to have much evidence against the defendant, and then at the 11th hour they come up with some goofball who was in the jail with him, who has a criminal record as long as your arm, and who says, yeah, well, he told me he did it.
That's law professor Ron Bretz, who has worked on the Freeman case. And he's talking about the jailhouse informant in this case, Philip Joplin. Freeman was arrested on November 14, 1986. He didn't confess to the police that he committed the Macklin murder, and he didn't confess to a man named Walter Jay, who was in the jail cell next to him.
I ended up next to Fred Freeman. That case was on the news every single day. Every radio station on our radio, because we had a portable radio in the cell, every 15 minutes they were talking about the Freeman case. And I found it kind of intriguing that I was locked up next to this guy, and he adamantly said, I didn't do this. I had nothing to do with this. I was 400 miles away from where this happened when it happened.
Indeed, no one from any correctional facility has come forward to claim that Freeman confessed in November, December, January, February, March, or at any point in time between May 1987 and April 2020. But on April 22nd, 1987, Philip Joplin sent a letter addressed to Prosecutor Bob Cleland. It started as follows.
Dear Mr. Cleland, last Monday, the 20th of April, I was in the holding cell to Judge Corden's court, awaiting sentencing in a receiving and concealing over $100 charge. In the cell with me was a guy named Fred Freeman. I sat in this cell for an hour and a half to about 2 hours listening to this dude talk. I guess he felt free to talk because I was an ex-con about to go back to prison for a short period of time.
Joplin then weaves the story about how Freeman confessed to him that he committed the murder, including the fact that the victim screamed when he was shot, which was surprising to Joplin, who, quote, thought you were just instantly dead. And according to Joplin, quote, I don't even know why he was telling me. I don't even know this dude, nor does he know me. Joplin then closed his letter as follows.
This guy appears to be very smart, and he thinks he's going to get out of this. He's definitely very confident of his alibi. He wouldn't tell me how he did that. He just smiled. Does that help any?
Freeman's trial started a mere 6 days later, and Joplin would become one of the state's star witnesses. His testimony began as testimony by jailhouse informants often does, with the prosecution trying to claim that he was an unincentivized good citizen serving only one master, justice. First, Cleland has Joplin state his criminal record, with Joplin saying he had 8 or 9 convictions stretching back to 1969, including 2 for forgery and 1 for receiving and concealing stolen property. Second, Joplin came forward with his story about being in that holding cell with Freeman between 1.5 and 2 hours, just after he was sentenced for his latest crime, meaning that he wasn't and indeed couldn't be seeking any leniency by coming forward. And third, Cleland had Joplin testify that he hadn't been fed any of the details of his testimony by police or prosecutors.
Yeah, I said that he said that he shot this guy with a shotgun. You know, prosecutor's office told me that when I made that statement to make sure that I turned towards the jury and looked at the jury.
If that's all the prosecutor's office told Joplin to do, things would have been fine, and the prosecution would have been the shrewd manager, spinning Joplin's straw into gold. But 3 years after Freeman was convicted, Joplin signed an affidavit claiming that hadn't been the case, and that it had instead been a case of an unjust steward. Or really, unjust stewards. In pertinent part, the affidavit states the following. As an inducement to having me testify against Mr. Freeman, I received promises from the St. Clair County's prosecutor's office and from the officer in charge of Freeman's case. Specifically, I was told by Prosecutor Houlihan that I would benefit from testifying and would make a lot of friends in the right places along the way. Detective Bounds told me more specifically what Houlihan meant. He said I would not be returned to prison, that I would be released into community placement, and that Houlihan would watch out for me to make sure all of this happened. All of this began when I wrote a letter to the St. Clair County Prosecutor's Office claiming that I heard something from Freeman about his case. Bounds and Houlihan had me transferred out of RGNC at Jackson to the Macomb County Jail. They saw to it that money was placed in my account, had me taken to the prosecutor's office to school me about what to say and what not to say for several days, and returned me to the Sanilac County Jail after I had testified against Freeman. From the Sanilac County Jail, I was placed into the Department of Corrections Community Residential Program, just as I had been promised. Contemporaneous records corroborate Joplin's claim. On April 28, 1987, the first day of Freeman's trial, Joplin's parole agent, Michael Barrow, sent Joplin a letter stating that he could, quote, request a commercial placement or a correction center in this county and should receive it without difficulty. This was then followed by a letter on May 28, 1987, by a man named Steve Spratzer to Art Holbert, the operations manager of community programs at the Department of Corrections. The letter stated,
I'm writing as a follow-up to our previous discussion about a client I'm doing some advocacy for. To quickly refresh your memory, Phil Joplin received some promises from the assistant prosecutor in St. Clair County as part of the deal to entice him to testify against a cellmate from the St. Clair County Jail. Our fear is that Assistant Prosecutor Houlihan has yet to initiate the community placement process. Phil would like to be placed in the Port Huron Correctional Center. We greatly appreciate any assistance you could offer. I'm enclosing a copy of the letter from Phil's PO, Barrow.
So, who is Steve Spratzer? Well, Colin spoke to him recently.
I was in a grad program looking at the role of the faith community in the criminal justice system, and Phil became aware of us, and like a lot of guys inside are leveraging any resources that we might have to help him, and so we did what we could. The guy, he got out and came to the Lansing area where I was in school and working at out of the church, and so I met him, learned about his lifetime of challenges, and next thing I know, he was off to Port Huron, where he had some deeper connections. I don't know if it was a girlfriend or what it was, but he was off to Port Huron, and then I get a letter that he's in the jail, and I had completely forgot that I wrote a letter on his behalf, but one of the investigators shared that letter with me on the church stationery, and I sort of recalled a bit about him feeling like he got taken advantage of by the prosecutor.
And that letter Spreitzer sent soon led to a reply letter from Hulbert. That letter stated,
"We have been in contact with Assistant Prosecutor Houlihan and have agreed to place Mr. Joplin in our Port Huron resident home program. One of our supervisors will be visiting him in jail and completing a program application. Following that, arrangements will be made to transfer him directly to our program in Port Huron. He will not be needed to route it through the prison system."
So, was Joplin incentivized into providing true testimony, or did he give false testimony in response to an offer he couldn't refuse? Colin asked Spreitzer about this.
"I just recall him speaking about, that he was cooperating with the, the prosecuting attorney or the authorities to help them with the matter they had so he could get out of jail. Basically, what I recall."
Uh-huh. And was he saying that to you in the sense of, "I'm just cooperating," or was it more along the lines of, "I'm making something up," or telling them what they want to hear?
Yeah, that's an important question. I think, more the latter. I mean, I did not, this was a painful conversation, as I recall it, for him, that he's caught with having given them kind of what they wanted.
Spreitzer's inference ended up being corroborated by Joplin himself when he was interviewed by reporter Bill Proctor and private investigator Alan Woodside a few years later.
"You seem like a decent dude, you know? You seem like a guy that, you'd meet on a college campus or something."
"You were talking about Mr. Freeman. It says the dude was telling me, yeah, he did it, but you'd never be able to prove it. Did Mr. Freeman ever really say that?"
"No."
"Did he ever say something about the victim screaming when he shot him?"
"No."
"Did he ever say he used a shotgun to kill somebody?"
"No."
Unfortunately, Joplin was terminally ill at the time of this interview, so he never submitted a new affidavit fully recanting his testimony. But Alan Woodside, the private investigator, summarized that interview in his own affidavit, and here are some of the key takeaways. 1. Joplin had heard of inmates getting favorable treatment for snitching, so he reached out to Prosecutor Bob Cleland, quote, "without any thought or concern in mind for the harm it would bring Freeman." 2. While Freeman told Joplin he was innocent, Joplin went to Cleland, quote, "with some common facts known to most everyone, and used them to weave a story about Freeman confessing." 3. After Joplin wrote the letter, he was transferred to another jail to avoid the news media and, quote, "admonished against saying anything in the event anyone were to attempt to question him." 4. Prosecutors and police discussed details of the case with him and, quote, "were manipulating and coaching him about how and what to say in arranging his testimony." 5. Joplin was promised a transfer to the community residential program in exchange for his testimony and was also given a VCR and clothes. And finally, 6, Joplin was controlled with the help of a local psychiatrist who had previously helped him with mental health issues. But even with these promises, Joplin still got cold feet.
"Somewhere along the way in talking to the police and the prosecutors, they asked you to say and do certain things."
"Yep."
"And you decided somewhere along the way that you didn't think you wanted to do that."
"Yeah, it was after they had snatched me out of here about 2 weeks after that, after I'd been going through all this thing with them, I wanted to back up out of it."
"And what did they say to you?"
"They got very mad and upset about that."
So are the reasons to believe that Joplin lied at trial and that what he told Woodside and Proctor was in fact the truth? To get some possible answers, I spoke with the leading experts on jailhouse informants. The first, Sasha Natapoff, a professor at the UC Irvine School of Law, spoke about the culture of informing in prison, which bears directly upon Joplin's explanation of why he implicated Freeman.
"There has grown up in the American criminal system and in the American carceral system in particular a a widespread understanding in jails and prisons that cooperation and information will trigger benefits. And so most informants will, individuals who come into jails and come into our prisons will learn or hear or come to understand that this is the deal. And so we've made a kind of announcement to the jail population that cooperation and benefits and leniency are always on the table.
And what about Joplin's claims about the benefits he was given?
Right, and so you specifically mentioned better placement. And so, you know, in this particular case, we have an individual who says, I was already convicted, I was already sentenced, I don't have any pending appeal. But what do you see in terms of informants coming forward to try to get better placement within a correctional institution?
There are all kinds of benefits that informants can get. As a matter of law, the government is almost entirely unconstrained in the kind of benefit they can give. Sheriffs and prosecutors can move individuals to more comfortable or advantageous placements. They can help with parole hearings that they often do. The government often comes forward later, even if they haven't promised an informant or made that as part of the plea deal. They'll come forward in subsequent hearings in an informant's case and represent to the court that this person has been helpful. We know stories about informants who were incarcerated who got money, they got phone privileges, they got sex, they got drugs, they got food, they got television, they got all kinds of things. So the range of benefits that are available and that we know that informants get really is only limited by their own imagination and the willingness of the government to give it to them.
Moreover, what about Joplin's admission regarding his mental health issues and not just his lengthy criminal record, but the types of crimes it was littered with? I spoke with Robert M. Bloom, a professor at Boston College Law School.
And you had also mentioned before looking at the mental health history of an informant, and how does that weigh into the analysis?
Certainly if there's an indication from previous counseling or psychiatrists, or there's something in the record that indicates this person makes up stories, or possibly what he's been convicted of, fraud, for example, or other kinds of crimes that would indicate lying, that becomes an important factor to think about.
And what can the use of jailhouse informant testimony tell us about the strength of the state's case?
I think the studies that have done of U.S. attorney's offices, of prosecutors, Yablonsky, I think, in Fordham, wrote an article about this. They are kind of aware that informants don't always tell the truth. That comes to, you know, tunnel vision, or they need the informants. Otherwise, if they didn't need the informants, they wouldn't use them. And the places where they need the informants the most is when they have a weak case.
Of course, Cleland claims that Philip Joplin fell into his lap at the last minute, which would mean that his testimony was not a commentary on his case. But Walter J., who, as we noted, was in the cell next to Freeman, suggests a competing narrative.
I was approached by two gentlemen. I believe one was Elwood Brown, and the other one, I believe, and I can't be for certain, was Robert Cleland. And they wanted to know if I could provide them with any information regarding Frederick Thomas Freeman. I got the impression that they would have cut me slack as a prisoner that was willing to say that he confessed to me. That was the distinct impression that I got from these two gentlemen.
Of course, this isn't concrete enough to say anything definitive, and it still wouldn't answer the question of whether Freeman confessed to Joplin. Freeman, though, adamantly denies that he confessed.
It was an insult, of course, just thinking I was so stupid I would even do something like that. To spend all my time telling anybody who would listen that I'm innocent, and suddenly to come forward and say, oh, but I'll tell you that I did it, and plus I'll tell you details about it, and that was very shocking.
But Freeman isn't the only one who denies it. Both Freeman and Joplin say they weren't alone in that holding cell.
Yes, it's a murder story. It's based on fact. It's called The Third Man.
The third man in this case, the only other person in the holding cell, was a man named Booker T. Brown, and the defense called him at trial. Brown had one prior conviction for breaking and entering, and he was currently being held on suspicion for a probation violation related to that crime. Brown's testimony was short, and for the defense, sweet.
Okay, and who was all in the room with you?
Me, Fred, and Joplin.
Okay, and you say Fred, you mean the defendant?
Right.
Mr. Freeman. And didn't a discussion begin by Mr. Freeman about his case?
Yes.
And can you tell us basically what he was talking about?
Well, he was saying that he didn't do it.
But Brown's testimony wasn't enough to dissuade at least one juror that Joplin was telling the truth. She would tell the local newspaper that it was Joplin's testimony that convinced her of Freeman's guilt. If Freeman were wrongfully convicted based on Joplin's testimony, he wouldn't be alone. According to a 2016 study by the National Registry of Exonerations, 81 of 116 death penalty exonerations, meaning 70%, involve perjury or false testimony by incentivized witnesses.
Another leading cause of wrongful convictions is ineffective assistance of counsel, and this is another aspect of Freeman's case. According to numerous people, defense counsel David Dean was a real-life doppelganger for a beloved sitcom character. Sometimes you wanna go where everybody knows your name. Cheers was a sitcom about recovering alcoholic Sam Malone, where, as the theme song makes clear, everybody knows each other's names. A fun concept for a sitcom, but probably not the best idea in real life. And according to Freeman, definitely not a good idea in the case of David Dean.
Yeah, he had all kinds of funny little odd jobs. We didn't find out till later that a year prior to my case, he was caught snorting cocaine in a park in Put-in Bay, Ohio. And he was actually on no cocaine, no alcohol probation during my case. Meanwhile, he owned and lived in a bar. And the judge overseeing his probation was my trial judge, James T. Corden. So that's how crooked those guys are down there. But here's a guy who's on no drug, no alcohol probation, who's supposed to be monitored and everything, and he's in a bar all night, every night. I mean, just shows you just like how really bad things were down there. They all knew this. And Bounds and Cleveland and all those guys were in his bar all the time, eating and drinking for free. Thomas Houlihan, all the crooked ones. Every crooked cop in that town, the O'Boyles, all the dirty ones, lived in his place. It was called a... Originally it was called Wall Street, and then he renamed it Keg and Kraut.
Most of this can be corroborated. David Dean used to be a prosecutor, working under Bob Cleland, the prosecutor at Freeman's trial, before leaving the prosecutor's office for private practice in 1983. The next year, in 1984, a quitclaim deed lists Dean and two prosecutors from Cleland's office as the owners of the property where Dean's bar was located. Later that year, the deed is placed in Dean's name alone. And the next year, in 1985, David Dean was indeed arrested for drug abuse and possession of cocaine. Then, in 1986, Dean was entered into the 3-year treatment in lieu of conviction program, which included the following condition. You shall not possess, consume, purchase, or have under your control any alcoholic beverages, nor shall you enter any place where alcoholic beverages are sold, except such places as where the sale of alcoholic beverages is incidental to some other primary business purpose. And yet, Dean not only owned and operated a bar that was frequented by prosecutors and police, but also ran his law office out of it, like the bowling alley law firm in the TV show Ed. Just operating and even being at this bar would have violated the conditions of the program. But there's also evidence that Dean was partaking of the beverages that he was selling. Here's Freeman's then-fiancée, Michelle Woodworth.
There were some times where he was, you know, he acted like he maybe had, you know, maybe had some drinks for lunch or something. I don't know. I never saw him do that, but I know that he just kind of, you know, acted like he could probably have done that when I would go in the afternoon.
And there's also evidence that Dean's cocaine use wasn't a one-time thing. Here's John Minnelli, the owner of the Karate Studio, who served as an alibi witness at trial.
Working with his lawyer, I don't know how he got that case or anything, but his lawyer seemed more interested in his secretary and lunches, and I don't know, he just seemed preoccupied the whole time, and you could tell
this is the 80s. Cocaine was rampant back then, and I have friends and everything like that. You could tell the guy was on something.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't really keep three thoughts in a row straight. He kept jumping all over the place, and he'd tell us one thing, and then he'd tell us another thing. It's like he had no idea what he was doing, it seemed like to me.
Right. And of course, he was ultimately disbarred for the drug use, right?
Oh, he was. Right. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, because it was obvious to Kathy, Mark, and myself that this guy was, there was something going on with him.
Right.
Freeman would eventually submit an affidavit during one of his appeals stating the following.
During much of the trial, Mr. Dean seemed confused and unfocused. He exhibited the signs of one with a drug addiction, sometimes seeming unaware of his surroundings and saying things that made no sense. He often smelled of recent substantial alcohol ingestion and appeared to be intoxicated. Many of the calls made to Mr. Dean by affiant were of necessity made to him at a bar, since that was the place where the affiant was most likely to reach Mr. Dean. During much of the trial, he seemed to take little interest in the proceedings and rarely objected to the admission of evidence, including evidence that seemed to affiant to be inflammatory and improper. Affiant understands that Mr. Dean was, during this time of his life, undergoing treatment for drug addiction and was an alcoholic, and this was common knowledge within the legal community in St. Clair County.
And as Freeman, who has noted, now goes by the name Temujin Kenso, told me recently, Dean's drug habit led to increasingly desperate behavior.
The problem was he was a crack addict, and of course I didn't know that. And just to understand, I've never been a drug guy. I had no idea what crack was. You know, this was 1986, and I'm living in the UP, and I've never been a drug guy. I've never been around drug people. You know, Tom Ford, Shelley, they'll tell you, we never had any drug people around us. Maybe somebody smoked a little marijuana, but no, you know, no heroin, cocaine, none of that kind of stuff. I knew nothing about crack. I knew nothing about AIDS. I was pretty, you know, sheltered life, I think. And so early on, he starts asking me for stuff, and he asks for an inventory of everything that I've got. And I wrote this handwritten inventory, of all my valuables, which were not much. And I had Shelly put my stuff in a storage bin at Shurgard. Now, what I didn't know was he was going into my Shurgard bin and, like, literally stealing everything that I had. And I have some of the documentation, I think I told you, where he forged a power of attorney. He authorized his friend Gary Knopf to go into the storage bin, and he wrote handwritten lists of things he wanted the guy to steal. In the meantime, he's coming back to me, and he's saying, well, the court's not going to give me enough money, but he wasn't doing anything, you know? And he was like, oh, I have to get these experts and all these things. And I'm like, well, the court's supposed to do that. I'm in the law library reading, and you're supposed to get all that covered by the court. So then he starts asking me for drugs. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, you know, you're like a rock and roll guy. You've got all these girlfriends. You know, you must get some cocaine. And I was like, dude, I live in a farmhouse in freaking Rock in the UP. What are you, nuts? Nobody uses cocaine up there, and I don't use cocaine. He goes, yeah, but you're like a heavy metal guy, you know, so you can get some drugs, right? And I was like, you've lost your freaking mind. And I told Shelley, I said, this guy's messed up. But there's nothing I could do. I didn't have any money. I couldn't get another lawyer. And the minute Shelley took off, he saw his chance to steal everything.
This claim of theft is corroborated by a man named Scott Mikula, who signed an affidavit in connection with the appeal. Mikula said that he facilitated crack and cocaine sales to Dean at his law firm slash bar in 1986 and 1987, and that Dean was using and abusing those drugs. And Mikula also stated that Dean suddenly came into possession of, quote, a vast array of martial arts equipment, bow hunting equipment, and an electric and acoustic guitar, some of the very items that Kenso says that Dean stole from him. Subsequently, in 1990, Dean was removed from a case when his client told the judge he had sold Dean drugs. And then later in 1990, Dean was arrested when police saw him accept a package that possibly contained cocaine, and Dean ended up testing positive for the drug. Soon, claims against Dean started flowing in, and it became clear he had been stealing money from client escrow accounts to fuel his drug habit. Dean was suspended and then disbarred, ultimately admitting that, quote, during the time you're abusing, it's like being in a cloud. You don't get your senses back until you remove yourself from that situation. You see it, but all you think about is your addiction.
The case of one man represented by Dean is especially pertinent to the Freeman case. David Dean represented a man named Randy Overton on a murder charge that would result in his conviction. Overton himself was a cocaine user and he recognized the signs of cocaine abuse by Dean, including, quote, extreme lack of ability to concentrate, confusion, and a lack of preparation. According to Overton, most of the work in the case was done by Janice Barnum, Dean's secretary. Barnum herself would then testify that Dean was using and abusing alcohol and cocaine continuously starting in January 1987, which is exactly when Dean was representing Freeman. A judge eventually granted Overton a new trial, highlighting the following.
But I guess the main reason that this court considers is the fact that Mr. Dean himself is involved in substance abuse. He has a substance abuse problem, which has not been refuted, and in my opinion, that would affect his status as a defense counsel in this particular case.
Similar evidence was presented at one of Freeman's appeals, including another claim by Freeman.
Now, he told me there's some court rule saying that I can't testify when everybody else has testified because it looks suspicious or some silly thing like that. I'm like, wait, tell the judge I want to testify. And I made a big scene about this. And he wouldn't do it, and I wasn't allowed to testify. And then he told the court that I didn't want to.
If Freeman is telling the truth, this was a violation of his right to testify. Dean, for his part, admits that not calling Freeman was a strategic mistake, but he claims it was jointly made.
The only thing I could have done on hindsight is I would have forced Fred Freeman to take the stand. And that was a mistake, but it was a decision we both made.
And then there's the conflict of interest that was never disclosed to Freeman. Sergeant Bounds, the lead officer in Freeman's case, had been removed from the Port Huron Police Department based on illegal gambling and numbers running. And you guessed it, David Dean was one of the attorneys who represented Bounds, at least as late as 1984, and who helped him get his job back. Here's the Honorable Thomas E. Brennan, the former Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, as well as Freeman himself.
The ineffective assistance of counsel, I think in this case, goes deeper than what you can see on the record. The fact, for example, that this defense lawyer had also been the lawyer for the chief investigating police officer some time before this case, which would give him sort of a classic conflict of interest.
He's best friends with everybody in the court. I mean, he has to endear himself to these people. This is where he lives and works, and he was not going to rock the boat for anybody, especially me.
So, given all this evidence of misconduct by defense counsel, the prosecution, and the police, you might wonder how Freeman was not granted a new trial. Well, the answer is, he was. And then, he wasn't. Next time, on Undisclosed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can support us at our Patreon site at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.